I am proud to be the son of two Second World War veterans. My father was a career man in the British Army as a musician. But he joined in 1935. He joined the Rifle Brigade and became part of the band of the Rifle Brigade. And at the beginning of the war, they stopped after 1940. But at the beginning of the war, they were still using musicians as stretcher bearers. And during the Battle of Calais in May of 1940, early part of May, they sent three of the different units and three of the different Rifle Brigades to Calais to hold down the German army there and help the armies at Dunkirk escape. My father was one, it's famous in England, but my father was one of the famous 47 who were pulled off the East Mole at Calais after the town fell. And by HMS Gulzar, which is a Royal Navy yacht. And the town was absolutely decimated. My father was shell-shocked for the rest of his life. So it's something that's always been very important to me. My mother was a Blitz survivor in Bristol. The whole house was wrecked around her. And my mother and my step-grandmother were under the stairs, which was a very classic thing if you didn't have a shelter. And they lived in the poor part of Bristol, where if you dug down 2 feet, you got water. So it's always been a, sort of a part of me. But my love is for aviation. Don't know how that happened. And 3 years ago, I put out my first aviation novel, World War II aviation novel, Sprague, A Novel of Bomber Command. And this tells the story of kids coming out of high school in 1941-42 and joining the Royal Canadian Air Force and learning to fly. Anybody here a pilot? Anybody here former Air Force? Sir. IRC or air crew? Air crew. Navigator? Oh, wow, that's fantastic. There's an entire chapter in Sprague in Mount Hope. Okay. But it gets them, the kids, before they go to war. So it gets them before 17,000 of them are not coming home. And it tells about their music and their films and their pop culture and all of those things, right? What I want to talk to you today is I want to talk to you today about the kids who are going through their training. But I also want to talk about why so many of them were crazy about aviation when the war started in September of 1939. And it has to do, a lot of it, well, we'll get to it when we get into it, but a lot of it has to do with the people in the 1930s who made it such a cool thing. First slide, please. Oh, I'm sorry. My fault. Usually when they give me these things, they don't work. So I get used to saying to somebody, next slide, please. All right. My main mentor in Sprague was a guy named Bob Middleton. Bob Middleton flew 33 missions in the Second World War as a navigator. He flew 10 on Halifaxes and 23 in Lancasters. This is his first real memory of aviation. This is the airship R-100, which came after it was launched, which came to Canada to sort of show off for the Vickers Company. And she was absolutely massive. She was also built correctly. The other airship, R-101, was not built correctly, and shortly after this photo was taken, R-101 wound up piled up in a French farmer's field and killed almost everybody on board. But R-100 was a beautiful craft. She was 700 feet long. Does anybody recognize this building? Anyone? Yes, who said that? That's $25 million. Sorry, that was the Blue Jays 50-50. Yeah, that's the Bank of Commerce building. And at the time, in 1930, it was the tallest building in the Commonwealth. And there she is overhead. Can you imagine a 700-foot airship, which is only 100 foot less, just over 100 feet less than the Titanic, is floating over your head there. It's an amazing memory. And so many of the old folks I talked to talked about this. Next slide. Oh, that's me. I'm sorry. Pardon me. Sorry. How many of you have heard of a guy named Bert Hinkler? Bert Hinkler. Now, remember that most of the boys who joined the RCAF were most of them were around 5 to 8 years old when Charles Lindbergh flew the Atlantic. And so they weren't really old enough to understand. But as they got into the early 30s, they started to really get into it. This is Bert Hinkler, and this is his famous Avroavian aircraft. He was Australian. And Bert did something that is so important to Canada because he did an epic flight where in 1931 he flew from Canada down the east coast of the United States all the way down to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, then became the first man to fly solo across the South Atlantic, then flew up the west coast of Africa and all the way to England where he finally landed. He also set the record that lasted for a long time for a solo flight to Australia for a number of hours. And nobody's heard of him outside of Australia. And unfortunately, the reason is because late in 1931, he was trying to set another record flying in northern Italy. And he made the mistake of flying into a cloud that had an Alp in it. An Alp had a mountain in it. And that was the end of Bert. So Bert may have become like the guy who's like the really most famous guy. But it didn't work for him. But strangely, the story of Bert Hinkler was one of the things that made, you know, that helped make aviation such a romantic thing for the boys of the 1930s, because it was so dangerous, right? Wap May, who's heard of Wap May? Now, see, Wap gets to be a little more famous. Wap May was a First World War veteran. He was a flyer in the Royal Flying Corps, and he was an ace. And when he left the Air Force, he became a bush pilot in northern Canada in the west. And Wap became very famous for two incidents. The first incident was there was a diphtheria outbreak in a small community in northern Alberta. And it was the middle of the winter and a blizzard, and they needed to get medicine up there. So Watt volunteered to fly in his little airplane with another guy all the way up there. And he became very famous for this because he had to land on a snowy river in order to get refueled, and he battled his way through the blizzard and the snow and alighted and was able to save the town. This was front page news across the country. Then a few years later, Wap winds up on the front pages again because of a crazy guy who was known as the Mad Trapper, who had a confrontation with two RCMP guys and shot one of them dead and then took off into the bush. And Wap flies, and they couldn't find him, so they got Wap, it's the winter, to see if he could find him. So Wap, knowing the guy was sticking to the rivers, flew up the rivers, the frozen rivers, and eventually he spotted a set of footprints. Uh-oh. I broke it. Hang on. Sorry. You should never trust me with these things. Hang on. I just broke it. Okay. So anyway, and he saw a set of footprints going into the bush, and the RSMP came rushing up in another plane, and they chased him down and shot him. Now, you meet all sorts of really neat people. They shot the mad trapper, by the way. I just wanted to make sure that we had the right person shot. You meet all sorts of interesting people at Probus's. I've met some really interesting people today. I was doing this talk at Wasega Beach, and a woman came up to me, and she said, it's a man who came up to me, I'm sorry, and said, you know the RCMP officer who got shot? And I, sure, I just talked about him, and he said, well, my mother dated the guy. And I said, oh, I'm very sorry that your mother lost her boyfriend. And he said, well, she always said to me that that guy was just the kind of idiot that would get shot in a situation like that, because the guy was a moron. there goes that great RCMP legend, you know. But it's really interesting who you run into. Next slide, please. You can't trust me. You really can't. Jimmy Doolittle. Now, everybody knows that Jimmy Doolittle is, you know, on April 18th, 1942, took 16 B-25 Mitchell aircraft off the aircraft carrier Hornet and bombed Tokyo and changed the course of the war and all of that stuff. What a lot of people don't know is that he was incredibly famous long before he did that. And he was an air racer. And all the boys loved this guy. And one of the things that he broke records all over the place for speed, including the Cleveland Air Races and all the things that you can break speed records for. And one of the things he broke it in this is the GB Racer. It's an engine. It's a powerful engine with elbows. And it took an awful lot of people got killed in these things. But Jimmy was able to break all sorts of records in this thing. And boy, was he well known. Next slide. However, and when I do this to women's Provost clubs, they love this part. I actually have an entire Women in Air Force Blue one I do for women's Provost too. But they love this part. Actually, the two superstars of aviation in the 1930s were both women. One of them, you know, we're going to meet in a second, and I ran into somebody just before the show who was born and raised in England, in Bedford. Has anybody here ever heard of Amy Johnson? One person. That's it. Amy Johnson was every bit as famous in Britain and the Commonwealth as the next person we're going to meet. She was pretty amazing. She came from a rich family. She and she talked her dad into buying her an airplane. Now, this is not that unusual. Airplanes were very, very expensive. And in order to afford one, you had to get somebody to sponsor you, or you had to get dad to buy it for you. So she got dad to buy it for her, right? And she set all sorts of records. Remember I told you about Bert Hinkler's record for flying solo to Australia? She set out to try to beat it and missed by 4 days, right? But it wasn't her fault, because she ran into a sandstorm in Arabia, and she had to land the aircraft, take apart the engine, put it back to clean out all the sand, put it back together again, and get going again. How's that for a modern woman? She was also featured on the front cover of British Vogue. So, you know, she was absolutely amazing. Set incredible records. Tried to set one from that started actually at Wasega Beach. And that didn't work, but that's the way it was in the 1930s. You tried things. She died in 1941, early 1941, when she joined what was called the ATF, And their job was to fly aircraft from the factories in Britain to the squadrons. That was their job. And so many women were part of that. And she either had engine trouble or was accidentally shot down over the Thames estuary in January of 1941. And she bailed out and hit the water. And there was one of His Majesty's transports was very close to her, and they sailed over to try to get her. And the strangest thing happened. Anybody here been a captain of a ship? No? Anybody here been in the Navy? Anybody recognize water when you see it? Okay. So this Royal Navy transport gets over to try to... The captain jumps in. Captains aren't supposed to do that. They have people for this. And he goes out to try to rescue her, and the water temperature is 26 degrees Fahrenheit, and he dies. And finally, they got his body back, but they never got Amy's body back, and she disappeared and was never seen again. Next slide. How many of you have not heard of Amelia Earhart? Now, in North America, she was, if you wanted to do it from an English standpoint, North America's Amy Johnson. Oh, my God, she was famous. And the boys loved her. She was just dashing and daring and set all sorts of records. And was the third woman, pardon me, was the third person to fly the Atlantic solo. The third. She also, by the way, worked during World War I as a nurse in a hospital in Toronto. I don't know how many of you guys are from Toronto, but the hospital is still there, or the building is still there. It's on the U of T grounds, and it's when you go north in Spadina from college, and then you have to take a right to go around the buildings that are in the middle of the little island there. Right, so the building's still there. Now, Amelia went from the most famous person in North America as a flyer in the 1930s to the most famous missing person in history in 1937 when she tried to fly around the world with her navigator, Fred Noonan, and they disappeared somewhere around a place called Howland Island. And ever since then, people have been trying to find her plane. It was a Lockheed. And next spring, yet another million-dollar expedition is going out to try to find her plane. They claim now they got it spotted. Not that when you think about it, it really matters. But what we've gone through here is how dangerous this is. It was really dangerous, but so exciting and so romantic. Next slide, please. Now, this was Bob Middleton's favorite magazine. Pulp magazines were a huge thing in the 30s and 40s for young people and into the 50s and stuff. And his favorite was Air Stories. Now, I love this for a number of reasons. First of all, as a writer, you gotta love the hyperbole. The Phantom Pirate of Jungle Skies. And in the bottom right, Yellow Death. Now, something it's funny because when I speak to women's groups, they don't notice it at first. And then when I pour it out, they all go, oh my God, that's correct. Okay? But here's this phantom pilot. They're trying to shoot down this pirate aircraft, trying to shoot them down. The woman's flying the airplane and the guy's doing the shooting, which is pretty cool, actually. But, you know, they read through this stuff all the time. Next slide. Here's another one that was really cool back then. Bill Barnes Air Trails. Now, Bob told me that one of the cool things about Bill Barnes Air Trails, 96 pages, 5 cents, is they would have these great stories in there about how to fix a radial engine or how do you navigate or, you know, so they all loved this and they just got so into it. Next slide. Biggles. Okay. How many of you read a Biggles book? One person. Two people. Both of them probably grew up in Britain. Biggles was huge. The Biggles books were just, the Biggles books were written by a guy who had been a World War I pilot. So his name was W.E. Johns, and he had been a World War I pilot. Now, what makes the Biggles books really interesting, is they held nothing back. One of the biggest fears of World War I pilots was having your aircraft being attacked and having your aircraft blow up. Having the gas tank, which was right in front of you, catch fire. Okay? And it was called by the pilots a flameroo. And you went down in flames. The problem was back then, and the Germans switched it in 1918, but they were the only ones who did. You didn't have a parachute. And the reason that they didn't have a parachute, it was claimed, was because people were concerned that if you had a parachute, you wouldn't be quite as brave in pushing forward on the attack. Now, I don't know about the rest of you guys, but if I had a parachute, I'd be much more brave about pushing forward into an attack. So one of the things that the pilots did, and they talk about this a lot in the Biggles books, and there's about 24 of them, they would take a pistol, and they would put the pistol down into their boot. So if the plane caught fire and they were at 5,000, 10,000 feet, they'd shoot themselves. Because that was the choice. Right? You either die in a flamer or you shoot yourself. And if you know you're going down in flames, you're down to a couple of choices. Some pilots actually jumped without a parachute. Right? So this is what the boys who were going to join the Royal Canadian Air Force were reading. They knew how tough this was going to be. And people say, oh, they're so naive when they joined the Air Force. No, they weren't. Next slide. And speaking of dark books, this is called Winged Victory, which I just reread about a year ago. It's by V.M. Yeats, who was also a fighter pilot in the Second World War. This thing is dark. Oh, my God. Because they were losing people so much. They had something called Bloody April in April of 1917 when the Royal Flying Corps lost over 300 pilots. I mean, it was... Now, of course, one of the reasons why you wanted to join the Flying Corps was so that you wouldn't be down in the trenches, where 10 million men lost their lives and you had to live no more than 2 feet from another guy for months at a time, surrounded by mud, being shelled all the time, and having rats with you and lice and all the rest of that stuff. So these guys got to go back to a clean bed, but it's still pretty, you know. And this was a huge, huge thing. Next one, please. Now, the war comes along. So when the war comes along, these folks are thinking, well, not yet. these folks knew that it was dangerous. And they were prepared for the danger. But what they weren't prepared for is they weren't prepared for the Air Force. Right? So this is what they thought the Air Force was really like. This film came out in late 1942. Ted Barris has a book about training in the BCATP, and it's one of the chapters is about the filming of this. So let's hit this, and you can see what the Hollywood came to Canada and made this film. Can we boost up the sound?
Fire! thought you'd get out of yourself, sucker. You know, she's nothing but a little...
Get out!
We've just had a call for every available Lockheed Hudson bomber to be sent over at once. So you men are leaving tonight. No obstacle. Breakdown, weather, enemy action must stop you. You've got to get them through.
Nobody but a chump would talk to a girl when he's kissing her. Nobody but a bush league would have to.
I suppose you wouldn't.
It's no fun in just supposing.
Well, a few things to straighten out.
Now, let's try to stick to one of them, huh? Do I fly that bomber?
There's something else.
Not to me, there isn't. There's only one thing that's important. I fly that bomber.
Wow, that was something, wasn't it? Don't go to the next slide yet for a second, please. So Michael Curtiz, who was the Hollywood director, came to Canada to make that film. Now, Michael had a problem, and the problem was that his last film was going to be a real disaster. Casablanca. So... the studio set him up here, and so he came off Casablanca and made this. Now, it was all very exciting and everything. There was a big Hollywood opening in New York, and some of the Americans really loved it, but it's like, we're up for the big show tonight, and, you know, and all the kids, when the war started, this is kind of the way that they thought, and the first thing that you had to do is you went to Manning Depot, and Manning Depot is basic training. So it was basically left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right. And your disciplinary corporal was usually permission to use a pejorative. Yes? Your disciplinary corporal is usually an asshole. And it was yours?
Yes.
Yes, right. And so I named my... I purposely named the DISIP Corp in Sprague Corporal Dyke, E-Y-C-K, which, of course, the boys instantly turned to Corporal Dick, and he was. But so you would go through that, but it was so exciting because you knew if you put up with what they like to refer to as the bullshit, you were getting closer to flying. It was going to be so exciting. I get to fly. I'm going to have an airplane. I'm going to be like captains of the clouds. I'm going to be like, you know, everybody in the... It's going to be wonderful, amazing. And then you went off to initial training and you ran into... Next slide. Uh-oh. We'll get there. Hang on. Next slide. Nope, we're going to go forward. God, there we go. Did you ever get in one of these?
No.
Poor Ed Link. Everybody's so excited to get into an airplane, they stick him in one of these things. Ed Link was a guy from upstate New York, and he was just trying to help, right? So he invents this Link trainer. And his parents had owned an organ company. So the Link trainer worked with air bellows like in an organ, right? And so they would have the guy sitting there in the left. This photo is actually taken at 1107 Avenue Road, which was number one ITS. Did you go to Avenue Road? Right, okay. It's a Catholic school and a condo building now, but so they went over to there and they stuck you in this. And this is how the Air Force figured out whether or not, first of all, whether or not you could be a pilot in this thing. And so what they would do is a guy on the left there, you'd hit a button, press, and the thing would go straight down. And then you were supposed to bring it back up to level. And then it would throw you over, starting into a roll, and you're supposed to bring it back. There's a working one in Ottawa, which is very cool. Or they might put you up here, and they could also put you into a spin to see if you could get it. By the way, folks, if you're ever flying an airplane and you go into a spin, this will save your life. Rudder full forward, stick full forward, rudder opposite of the spin you're in. So if you're in a left spin, you press the right rudder as hard as you can, and you shove that stick forward, and she'll come right out of the spin. Which is easy enough to explain now, but if you're actually in a spin, and you've never been in a spin, it's like, press the right rudder! What? Press the right rudder! The left one? No, the right one! 195,000 young men went through the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan. And for many of them, this was the last of their dream to become a pilot. Because the RCAF, so you washed out. But the RCAF was not stupid because they had lots of other jobs. You could be a navigator, which was the next best thing. You could be a radio operator. You could be a gunner. So you see, they had things for you to do. They weren't going to get rid of you unless you were really stupid. And they sent you to Trenton for retraining, and you did a lot of floor mopping. Next. Now, this is where the airplanes come in. I love the yellow airplanes. This is a DH-82C Tiger Moth. Now, the Tiger Moth, when it was originally built by de Havilland in England, it had open cockpits. Can somebody tell me what might be a problem with open cockpits learning to fly in Canada? See, you all got it. It's freaking cold. Yes. So they got, it's kind of hard to see because it's not quite dark enough here. But they have coop tops. So there's a coop top. So then the guy in the back seat, which was the trainee, would pick it up and throw it forward. And then the pilot in the front, the instructor, would close it. So that way you could train in Saskatchewan in January. And they built over 100 airfields across Canada for the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan. Pretty much every little town that has an airfield because of the BCATP, which is really neat, including the Peterborough-Lindsay area. So you got to fly in this. What was so wonderful about this is it looked like the World War I aircraft still that you wanted to, you know, that you grew up wanting to do. It was amazing. And one-third of the people got into this aircraft, washed out, and were sent for retraining. But this was a very simple aircraft to fly if you could do it. I remember they were asking these kids to think in 3D, in three dimensions. And some could just do it. And something that they realized, if you knew how to ride a bicycle, you could usually learn to fly in this thing because you had an understanding of how it worked, right? And something else to understand, too, is that if you're in high school and you were an athlete, a good athlete, you were heading for the Air Force because they wanted you. So all the football players and hockey players and all that sort of stuff. So many of them wound up as pilots and as air crew. Next. So here you are in elementary flight training, and you either flew the one I just showed you, the Moth, or you flew the Fleet Finch. Now, the Fleet Finch was considered by people to be actually somewhat better than the Moth, though only 9 of the elementary training schools had the Fleet Finch. She was more difficult to fly, which is why a lot of people liked her better. The instructors liked her better because she was more difficult. She was built, actually, at Fleet Aircraft in Fort Erie, Ontario, which is cool. Now, most of the Tiger Moths that we flew here also were built in Canada. We built thousands of aircraft during the Second World War, most of them trainers. But the Fleet Finch was a very powerful aircraft, and they liked her. But unfortunately, if you see the engine at the front, You'll get this, the people who are Provost clubs get this because they're former business people and stuff. Unfortunately, when the United States entered the war, it was decided as a group, you know, between the British, Canadians, the Americans, that they would cut the number of engines they built down to 5. And that engine did not make the list, so therefore they couldn't fly Fleet Finches anymore, which is kind of cool in a way. But they wanted to streamline everything. Next. Now, once you came out of elementary flight training, if you were still going to be a pilot, now they streamed you into either fighter pilot or bombing reconnaissance. And if they sent you off to a bomb to be a in a bombing aircraft, you would either fly a Cessna Crane or the beautiful Avro Anson. And the Anson was, she was known as the Faithful Annie. And this was the first twin-engine aircraft you got your hands on. She wasn't that big. She'd fit in this room. And she was a bit challenging to fly, which was good. But this is how you learned. Now, why did so many British pilots, Australian pilots, New Zealand pilots and stuff, and Americans, 9,000 American young men joined the Royal Canadian Air Force before Pearl Harbor because they weren't damn well going to wait? Why did they choose to fly these beautiful aircraft and things in Canada? What made Canada a great place to learn to fly? Nobody was shooting at you. Okay? Because if you were trying to do this in Britain, you'd be up there and some night fighter, Ju-88 night fighter from the Luftwaffe, would come up in your tail and whack you out of the sky. Plus, there were too many other aircraft flying around. So they needed to go to Canada with the wide open skies. A problem, by the way, with training here in Canada was that for the navigators, we would, for the first few years of the war, we were sending lousy navigators. And the reason we were sending lousy navigators is because here in Canada, they were cheating. Does anybody, the idea of being a navigator is to find your way from here to there, to there, to there, and back again. Anybody figure out why they were cheating here? Because the lights were on. So if they told you at Mount Hope in Hamilton to fly to Toronto, you got up there and went, oh, look, there's Toronto. Whereas in Britain, it's all blackout, so you don't know where you are. So we started sending some really bad navigators over there. And finally, they came up with the idea of an AOS, which is an advanced observer school, where you could learn advanced navigation. And they sent everybody out to the prairie so that when you took off from Winnipeg, there's Brandon over here in black. And they flew you into the black, right? Because that's how you learn to navigate at night properly. But this is Bill Reed's beautiful Anson. He's just sold it, as a matter of fact. She lives in the South Island in New Zealand. She is the only flying version of an Anson in the world. The two that fly in England are post-war Ansons, but this is the only actual World War II one. And Bill Reed and his wife, Jill, who died about 15 years ago, this was their big dream to put it together. And the Anson, funny enough, when she flew like I stand here. She bobbled. Okay? She's going along. And it's great to see the cockpit views from the end. The joke about the Anson was that she was 30,000 individual parts all flying together in formation. Isn't that great? I love that joke. That's a World War II joke. So you would learn to do this, and you were going to be a bomber pilot. And a lot of you were going to die because the bomber pilots, the Canadian bomber pilots, not all of them, but a huge number of them, flew in number 6 Group Bomber Command, which was Canada's own bomb group in Britain, in Bomber Command. We had our own bomber group. We had so many pilots. And the losses there was some up around 70%. 70%. Bomber Command suffered 57,000 casualties, dead, in the Second World War, and 10,000 of them were Canadians. It's incredible what we gave. Incredible. Next slide. Now, you also did navigating training in an ensign. And finally, we did start to you know, put out some really good navigators. They had to all had to be retrained in Britain when they first got there. So your view of, this is over southwestern Ontario. Anybody here from southwestern Ontario? So you would know then in southwestern Ontario that every small town out there has like a small airfield or an ex-airfield. That's because southwestern Ontario was like a main hub of the BCATP. Everybody, the most beautiful of them was Dunnville, which is an airport they closed because somebody thought it would be a good idea to put giant windmills right next to it, and they had to close the airport. That was a bad day for the birds around there, I'll tell you. Another head off a raptor. Next slide. Now, it could be dangerous. This is an incredible story. This is from a place in Australia called Brockaberry. And what had happened here is that two ensigns came into land at the same time. And the guy in the bottom didn't see the guy at the top. They're yellow, damn it. The planes are yellow. They're yellow so you can see each other. But they didn't see each other. And they collided with each other. And they stuck together. And the people, the small number, I think it was three people, a pilot and two navigation students, jumped out of the one at the bottom. And but the guy flying in the one at the top was on his first solo flight. And he realized that his engines were no longer working, but the engines of the aircraft below were working. And then he realized that his own avionics were working. He still had his rudder. He still had his vertical stabilizer. He still had everything that he needed. So he landed this thing from 3,000 feet. And fortunately, it was a big airfield because there was no way to stop the engines below. And he just sort of like steered it into a position that the thing would stop. And he gets out, and the instructor gets up, and he says to him, "Okay, you pass." Very famous one. Next one. This one from out west. This is two Cessna cranes lying on top of each other. This has been shown in aviation books and stuff over the years as two cranes that bumped into each other. It's not at all. These are two cranes that crashed individually, and I was able to discover it by looking it up. There's an amazing man who put out a history of every single aircraft that flew in Canada. And they crashed a week apart, but they were actually piled up at the end of the airfield where they needed to just pile up crashed airplanes. It was dangerous. And if you know from the beginning of my talk, which is almost over, if you know from the beginning of my talk that the students coming in, they knew it. They knew how dangerous this was. They didn't come in naive. They knew. And we lost 1,700 air crew in training. Go ahead, next one. Oh, she still gives me, I get excited when I see this. This is a Harvard. She was built by North American Aviation, first in Texas, and then we built them under license in Montreal and Thunder Bay. She is one of my favorite aircraft of the war. This was the aircraft they put you into if you were going to be a fighter pilot. And she was fabulous. And there are still tons of them still around because they were such a tough aircraft. And they built so many of them. And in Tillsonburg, Ontario, they have the Canadian Harvard Aircraft Association. And they bring in Harvards from all over the place for their November and stays, Remembrance Day stuff. And she had an incredible engine. And the thing about that engine is that it had There was a little something about the spinner that created a very special sound. So you knew when a harvester went over because you sounded like this. And then when six went over, it was like, oh my God. Just fantastic aircraft. And she was known as the pilot maker. Because if you could fly a Harvard and do it well, you could fly any fighter aircraft. As a matter of fact, North American smart people at North American, the cockpit of a Harvard, which in the United States is known as a Texan or an SNJ in the Navy, the cockpit layout was exactly the same as the P-51 Mustang. So if you learned on a Harvard and they put you in a Mustang, you just went, okay, I know all this. Right? The only difference was no guns.
Where was it manufactured?
It was in Canada. It was manufactured in Texas, but in Canada it was manufactured at Canadian Car and Foundry in Montreal or in Fort William. Yep. We built hundreds and hundreds of these. And they're just so wonderful, and I love this aircraft. So away you went. Next slide. And I love this, too, because I'm going to go up on the stage. This is Don Connolly's wonderful aviation artist. This is something you're going to remember, sir. See these H-shaped buildings here? There's nothing that the young men remembered more from their training as H-shaped buildings. Because this was two barracks and an ablution area. Ablution is shaving. Peeing, pooping, right? So it's ablution area. But this is what those 100 airfields they built across Canada, this is what they all looked like. The other thing that was neat about this, and businessmen, you'll appreciate this. Beginning of the war, some guy went to the Royal Canadian Air Force and said, I can supply you with endless amounts of brown linoleum for your buildings. And so every, at a cheap price, God, he made $1 million. So every RCAF building in Canada had this brown linoleum in it. And I've talked to ex-Air Force people, and they've said, yep, I remember that brown linoleum, even if they trained in the 60s. Right? Next. Okay. We have had some fun today. We've told some good stories and that sort of thing. This is an air observer class. This is a class of air observers in Edmonton, at an air observer school in Edmonton. And if you look here, you can see there's 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24 students in that picture. This photo was taken in 1943. 17 of these young men are not coming home. 17 of them. It was really something. God, the sacrifice that we made for the air war in the Second World War was just unbelievable. Next slide. Who's this? Yes, sir. Who got that one? Yes, sir. William Avery Bishop. He was the guy who got everybody to come and join, you know, everybody interested. But the biggest thing that he did for the war effort, and this guy shot down 72 planes in the First World War, and if anybody wants to take me on with the, oh, Billy Bishop made up some of those kills, you can meet me at the back here after we're over, and we'll have that argument, and I'll win it. Okay? Billy Bishop. So... He actually appears in Captains of the Clouds. This is a scene from Captains of the Clouds, and he did a great job in that. But he was a recruiter. That's what he did during the war, and he was the guy who came and gave you your wings, and you felt so proud of yourself. And he would say the same thing when you go up and shake a guy. Now, remember, we don't see the enemy as being a bad guy. We're not shooting down the enemy. We're shooting down an aircraft. That was the First World War ethic, right? That wasn't the thing in the Second World War. But he was just great. But he came up with this plan because they didn't have enough instructors at the beginning of the war. So Billy knew a guy in the United States. And they cooked up a plan. You see, because in the United States, you couldn't come at that time because they had a neutrality act. You couldn't come across the border to teach people to go off to war. So they cooked up an idea. They came up with a fake aviation training school, Canadian Aviation Association. And they put ads in U.S. newspapers saying we need really experienced pilots who will come up here and help train civilian pilots. So they would get hired. They'd come to the border and they'd say, I'm coming up here to train civilian pilots. And the guy at the border would say, sure, okay, off you go to Canada. So you go to Canada. Then you went to either Toronto or Montreal, but in Toronto you went to this office. And the office said, CAA, this is before the other CAA, and, oh no, I'm sorry, it's Dominion Aviation Association. And you'd walk in and you'd say, hello, I've been hired by you guys. And they had a secretary there. And the secretary would say, I'm sorry, we have too many pilots. We can't take on any more. The person said, well, what can I do? And the person would say, well, it just so happens the RCAF recruiting office is next door. Isn't that great? I love that. And they go next door and they become pilots. Next slide. And we come to the end. I consider this gentleman here to be, in a way, the person who is most symbolic of all of the young kids who went through aviation training in Canada. This young man was born in Hong Kong. And his parents were in Hong Kong as Christian missionaries. I met somebody doing this talk whose aunt had actually lived with these two Christian missionaries in Hong Kong. And but he was British. Both of his parents, one of his parents was British, his mother, and his father was American. So when he was born in Hong Kong, he became, because of the rules then, because his father was on a Christian mission, he became an American citizen. But they sent him off at 10 years old from Hong Kong to British public schools, private schools, to get his education. And when the war started, that was when they sent him for a year to Boston University to get him out of Britain while the war was going on. And then he joined the Royal Canadian Air Force. Now, when he came to the Royal Canadian Air Force as an American, he had the right to wear, as the 9,000 Americans who joined, the patch, USA. And he chose not to. You can see there, he's getting his wings here. And that patch is not there. And if you were from Australia, you had Australia or Brazil or New Zealand or whatever. He chose not to because he felt as though he were a citizen of the world. He'd only been to America for 1 year. His name, well, let me finish the story quickly. He went to England and became a Spitfire pilot. One day, about a year after he got there, he was out training with three other Spitfires. And it being England, it was cloudy. They couldn't find a hole in the clouds. Finally, a hole in the clouds opens up. And he leads the section of Spitfires down through the hole. And as they go through this hole in the clouds, he runs directly into a training aircraft, an Airspeed Oxford, was going, just tooling along, smashes into it. And his Spitfire starts to fall, and he was desperately trying to get out of it, and he gets out, but too low. Parachute comes out. But it was too low, and he was killed. His name is John Gillespie McGee. And he left us with the most famous poem of the Second World War. I made a promise to Bob Middleton, who died at 99 doing his laundry. I made a promise to Bob Middleton, who was my main mentor in Sprague, that every time I did this talk, I would present this poem. Next slide. Cataracts, gotta go to the front. Oh, I have slipped the surly bonds of earth and danced the skies on laughter-silvered wings. Sunward I've climbed and joined the tumbling mirth of sun-split clouds and done 100 things you have not dreamed of, wheeled and soared and swung high in the sunlit silence. Hovering there, I've chased the shouting wind along and flung my eager craft through footless halls of air. Up, up the long, delirious, burning blue, I've topped the wind-swept heights with easy grace where never lark or even eagle flew. And while with silent, lifting mind, I've trod the high, untrespassed sanctity of space, put out my hand and touched the face of God. And I thank you for your time today.